It's going down, and you're invited for what they selling. We ain't buying, there is no running, there is no hiding, there's only fighting or dying. It's going down, and you're invited for what they selling. We ain't buying, there is no running, there is no hiding, there's only fighting or dying.
It's Going Down is a digital community center from anarchist, anti-fascist, autonomous, anti-capitalist, and anti-colonial movements. Our mission is to provide an autonomous and resilient platform to publicize and promote revolutionary theory and action.
Go to itsgoingdown.org for daily updates. Check out our online store for ways to donate and rate and follow us on iTunes if you like this podcast. Along with obsession over Antifa, the growth of the Democratic Socialists of America, or DSA, in the wake of Bernie Sanders' failed presidential run, has garnished mass attention in the press, been demonized by the right, and also embraced by some sections of the liberal class as the new shepherds of the Democratic Party. Meanwhile, the DSA has continued to explode in membership, hitting over 50,000 dues-paying members in recent weeks. While some DSA-backed politicians have become household names, as the DNC-aligned media smells blood in the water in the lead-up to the midterms, DSA chapters have also become a fixture of protests and demonstrations, from fighting against the alt-right to supporting strikes. But key questions remain. Will the DSA be used, much as Bernie Sanders' campaign was used, to activate key sections of millennials and the working poor and prime them for the elections? And moreover, when the time is right, will the DSA march them willingly into the waiting arms of the Democratic Party machine after months of building excitement over socialism? In many ways, this process is already happening. As Democratic political hopefuls clamor for DSA backing in some cities, which would mean not only an endorsement, but access to grassroots support and willing volunteers. And those that have been given the DSA stamp of approval have also been very clear about what form of socialism they are talking about, not a fundamental rearrangement of the relationship between human beings and the means of existence for the benefit of those who work for wages or are in misery because they do not have any, but simply a repositioning of priorities over what tax dollars are spent on. Perhaps only $50 billion on the military next year, and the library can stay open on Friday. And let us say that the DSA is successful in creating a neo-social democratic current within the Democratic Party. Will the granting of basic reforms such as universal healthcare be able to make a dent in the crises that are on the horizon, which include the collapse of worldwide ecosystems which produce food and oxygen, the rising of sea levels and the proliferation of millions of climate refugees, an onslaught of chaotic weather patterns brought on by resource extraction and fossil fuel consumption. Many scientists contend that unless drastic changes are made in the next 10 years, mass extinction, including our own, is a very real possibility on a global scale and may in fact be unavoidable. There is also the continued growth of the wealth gap, homelessness, poverty, neocolonial racial configurations, and precarity among the vast majority of the workforce as automation displaces millions of workers and the gig economy and tech giants redefine everyday life, while gentrification continues to push working people farther and farther away from where they work and farther away from a center of power they could possibly disrupt. What about the rise of fascist and right-wing populist currents that will present themselves as tangible and even at times ecological and anti-capitalist alternatives to neoliberalism, of which the Social Democrats will become simply the new face of? There's also the mass proliferation of surveillance and spy technologies, coupled with ever-increasing militarization of police. Not to mention the escalating social crisis, fed by declining material conditions, but also a growing dependency on technology that helps engender a fierce alienation from the rest of society, coupled with the very real desire by those excluded from the modern world to end their own lives and those of people around them. This will continue to manifest itself in burgeoning suicide rates, mass shootings, and explosion of mental illness and untreated trauma. The point in bringing any of these examples up is that fundamentally, there is not an electoral strategy that can legislate these things away. Coming close to even addressing these problems would fundamentally mean creating entirely new forms of life, new ways of relating to each other, new ways of sustaining ourselves, and new ways of making day-to-day decisions that impact our lives. As a recent guest on the podcast stated during the discussion on the new book Inhabit, you can't legislate a melting ice shelf. But on the other hand, others would point to a variety of programs and social struggles the DSA members have gotten involved with, many times side by side with anarchists and autonomous. Some would argue that there are just as many people involved in DSA that are interested in direct action, community organizing, and building power from the bottom up as there are those that want to spend their time and energy on electoral politics. Others would argue that for many young people wanting to get involved in anti-capitalist organizing, the DSA is simply the only game in town. In our next three podcast episodes, we will explore these tensions as we talk to people both outside and inside the DSA and discuss the organization with members that see it both in a critical light as well as those that see it as something with an immense potential. This will include a conversation with a member of the Black Rose Anarchist Federation, who argues that fundamentally elections and voting are a waste of time, and that even on the terrain of fighting simply for concessions from the state or the economy, much less trying to reappropriate our lives, social movements are a better way of fighting the rich and powerful than voting for a section of them. We also attack the idea of, quote, fighting with both fists or combining electoral and street movements. Moreover, our guest discusses several post-Occupy and socialist politicians in power, from Kashama Swaint on the Seattle City Council to political parties like Syriza, and explains why these formations always fail, because politics is all about managing class society, not abolishing or bending the fundamental rules, which make some destitute and powerless and others with their fingers on the button. Next, we will present a group discussion with members of the Communist Caucus of the DSA out of Oakland, California. The Communist Caucus are not Marxist-Leninists, but anti-state communists in the vein of the Situationist International, the Invisible Committee, and proponents of communization theory. The Communist Caucus are amazing to speak to because they originally joined the DSA in the hopes that it would attract a large barrage of people that wanted to get organized and involved in the wake of Trump's presidency. Instead, they found by and large another group that simply wanted to canvass for policy changes and elect local politicians. In response, they have launched a direct action-oriented housing organization named TANC, or Tenant and Neighborhood Councils, and continue to push from within DSA against the electoral drift towards the Democrats. Finally, we present a conversation with two individuals that are part of the Libertarian Socialist Caucus of the DSA, or the LSC, which according to the folks we talked to is the largest caucus within the DSA and currently has over 500 members and includes a growing army of locals. The LSC sees itself as a big tent within the big tent, meaning that they are open to all non-electoral or anti-authoritarian socialists, anarchists, and communitarians. Moreover, they are critical of elections, but they seem to be more interested in focusing around building grassroots campaigns, infrastructure, and community organizing projects rather than trying to cause a split within the DSA over electoralism. They argue that unlike many anarchist groups and projects that are closed off and hard to find, DSA is wide open and accessible for anyone, and it makes sense for anti-authoritarians, anarchists, and autonomous anti-capitalists to build a home inside of it. Will the DSA simply be used as a socialist lipstick placed on the Democratic Party? Will we soon be facing down riot police in the streets under the orders of socialist politicians? Or will the DSA eventually fracture and split around tensions of electoralism and their relationship to the Democrats themselves? Moreover, should we push to hasten this split, bringing over those that seek to build from the bottom up into our own movement? On the other hand, what of those that argue that instead we should fight from within the organization now, as anarchists and anti-authoritarians already have a foothold inside the DSA? We are excited to hear what you think. And with that, let's get into it. Okay, we're talking today with somebody from the Black Rose Anarchist Federation. We've been lucky enough to talk to people with Black Rose in the past, so if you want to go back and listen to the other podcast and learn more about what Black Rose is and some of the stuff about what it does, feel free to check out our show notes. You can see that link. But today we're going to be talking to somebody from Black Rose specifically about electoralism, about the difference between social movements and the left in electoral power within the state and the pitfalls of that. And obviously why, from an anarchist perspective, we want to be critical of that and share criticism of that, and also encourage people to get involved in organizing and social movements wherever they are. And Black Rose has done a very good job about continuously writing about these subjects to produce, you know, theory and critique about the state, about electoralism. So we're going to be talking about that. And also, in the same vein, DSA, the rise of electoral social democracy that a lot of people are getting interested in the United States to some degree. But do you just want to introduce yourself real quick and just maybe tell us where you are and what group you're with?
Sure. So like you said, I'm with the Black Rose Anarchist Federation. My name is Patrick. I'm based in the Burlington, Vermont area. So certainly deep in the heart of Bernie country, but also, as we may chat about later on, deep in the heart of Bookchin territory too.
Oh, so many things we could talk about.
Fun so, never stops up here.
Let's get into it. All right. So Black Rose talks a lot about, and I like this, the left in power and just kind of the pitfalls of this. And I think that you hit on two really interesting sweet spots. Black Rose has written pretty heavily about two examples. One is the socialist alternative candidate in Seattle. The name escapes me right now. She's been in office for a couple years. Mm-hmm. And also the kind of, I don't know how you would describe it, kind of populist but also kind of like social democratic party Syriza in Greece, and just how these people and parties have come into office and they really haven't been able to deliver on kind of the mandate that the people gave them were coming in. And I was just curious if you can talk about this.
Sure. And that's a good combination, talking about Kashama Sawant in Seattle and Syriza in Greece, because they're both really good examples of politicians who, you know, ran an electoral campaign that claimed leadership of a social movement and then not only failed to deliver on what they promised, but actually probably ended up getting a worse deal than if they hadn't gotten in power at all, which is remarkable. So like for Sawant's case, you know, her big platform was riding the wave of the 15 an hour movement, which had been really happening all across the country at that point. So her and Socialist Alternative wanted 15 now. That was their slogan. That's what was on all their placards. But as so often happens when you have electoral politics, what happens on the campaign trail is kind of different what happens in office. So 15 now became more like a 15 later. The labor union leaders who sort of opportunistically supported her candidacy, which got her into the city council, they threw their weight behind this watered down compromise bill, which was not, you know, nearly anything close to 15 now. It was 15 for some people, accepting these large loopholes and phased in over all these years out into the 2020s. So it was a total mess. And I mean, to her credit, Sawant opposed the compromise bill. She was suggesting, okay, let's play our hand and put down for a referendum. So we'll put a really strong $15 an hour law on the ballot. Let's do this. But of course, because the unions that backed her, that would have provided the logistical support for her, were backing this compromise bill, that fell apart. So in the end, she ended up voting for it and is now sort of like touting it as, you know, this big victory she won. But the funny thing is, if you go back to when she was campaigning against the incumbent, who was this sort of like middle of the road, milquetoast Democrat, Her opponent said, you know, he wasn't necessarily opposed to 15 an hour. He just said, well, it needs to be sort of phased in a thoughtful way, which is exactly what
ended up happening.
It's like, it would be hilarious if it wasn't so sad.
I mean,
and wasn't so harmful for the working class in Seattle, given the alternative that happened right next door in SeaTac.
I mean, other cities really were like, you know, we'll, like in Berkeley, I think they were talking about 19 an hour by like 2022 or something like that, which is, you know, nowhere near living wage, nowhere near enough to like get an apartment. So, I mean, it just, I mean, literally table scraps, but also table scraps 5 years from now.
Right, exactly. And things would have been very different, I think, if they had taken the model of SeaTac, which for listeners who don't know the Pacific Northwest, that's the sort of a bedroom community between Seattle and Tacoma that contains the big airport. And what the labor movement there did was they put a referendum on the ballot, which had much fewer loopholes. 15 was phased in much, much quicker. It may have been immediate for some sectors, much more aggressive, and it passed overwhelmingly. And they didn't have to change the mayor of SeaTac. They didn't have to change counselors. The oppositional social movement energy that coalesced behind the referendum stayed oppositional and independent. So it's, yeah, it's a total sham. But yeah, with your second example, Syriza, of course, referendum appears in a rather different kind of way and light. With Syriza, so as we all may recall, in 2015, Syriza came into power on really riding a wave of popular opposition to austerity measures in Greece. And those austerity measures were imposed by what they called the Troika. So that was, the European Commission, the European Central Bank, and the International Monetary Fund. Hopefully most listeners are familiar with and have hopefully protested the IMF, at least. That's a boogeyman I think a lot of us know. So once they won, you know, this was the party that was supposed to take up the banner of what PASOK, which was sort of the moderate center-left party, used to be. You know, when PASOK came into power in 1981, they were the leftist darlings of Europe. You know, they had really aggressive plans. They had a social movement base. Syriza had all that. But, you know, while all these leftists across the globe, especially in the U.S., were just going gaga over them, if you watch closely, you could see as of day one, their leaders were far more cautious than they were during the campaign. And honestly, further to the right than the social movements that actually helped them get into office. So the first few months when they were in office, they were trying to essentially persuade and convince the Troika that, well, we're a new party, the people voted, so clearly you have to give us a better deal because they voted in a new party. And the Troika just laughed at them. They said, no, you know, the finance minister for Germany said, well, elections shouldn't change economic policy. And he was right, you know, that's the line. So they had this really, frankly, naive view of the relationship between capitalism and the state, and the relations of power, you know, in the EU in general. So that also explains why they put up this referendum vote. So early that summer, after they got in, they negotiated a really horrible deal, and they put it up to a vote, and they told the Greeks to vote no, so they have more leverage going back and negotiating with the Troika. And of course, they had just voted earlier that year, and it, you know, it gave them no leverage when they went back to Brussels. So they hold the referendum. Overwhelmingly, the Greek populace votes no. This is a horrible, horrible deal. This is more austerity measures. This is more, you know, selling off of public assets. And so instead of breaking off with austerity as Syriza pledged, they went back to Brussels. And they ended up signing an even worse deal than the one there was a referendum on. So that means millions of dollars worth of public assets, everything from post offices to major ports. Those were all on the chopping block, thanks to Syriza. funnily enough, locally, I went to a debate that our local ISO chapter had about Bernie Sanders at the time. Mm-hmm. And this is like 2 weeks after the referendum and after Syriza had folded completely. And, you know, in the Q&A at the end, ISO members were still like touting them as this positive example, this shining beacon of what, you know, the left in power can do. And I said, yeah, you're more right than you know.
Yeah. Well, you know, we're gonna get into so many of the aspects of why this is true throughout this conversation. But thanks for the introduction of that. With all this in mind, though, I think a lot of people are right now, or at least some people, because I mean, I don't know if you saw the map that was just put out on Twitter. Like they showed, you know, counties that didn't vote and that was represented by like dark spaces and, you know, like vast, huge areas of the country that, you know, didn't largely majority of people in counties, you know, did not vote. So there's still huge swaths of America that by and large, most people want nothing to do with either party. But, you know, there are more and more people that are getting excited about the DSA, especially with new people either getting backed by the DSA or winning certain elections. I think some people might ask, you know, why would you want to kind of rain on this parade, so to speak?
Well, I don't know. I think I would tell them that they have a very low bar for what is parade worthy. There have been waves of progressive, you know, elected leftists, both inside and outside of the Democratic Party in the past. You know, we've seen this movie before. I don't know if your listeners will recall, but during George W.'s first term, there was a green wave. So Green Party candidates were just sweeping, you know, local municipal offices. John Eder in Maine, just a few states over from me, became the first Green Party state rep elected. That was 2002. Matt Gonzalez, the Green Party city councilor in San Francisco, came within a breadth of winning the San Francisco's mayoral race.
Right.
So they won a ton, and people were predicting. I am sad to admit I was a Green Party member back then. And in these internal conversations, you know, people were predicting, oh, well, the first Green member of Congress by 2006. We got this. We can do it. But as it turns out, everything petered out, either because the momentum subsided. Sometimes, like in the course of John Eder in Maine, Greens were actually redistricted by Democrats out of their own seats. So the same shenanigans that Republicans do, the Democrats complain about, the Democrats did to Green Party people. Because this isn't, you know, this isn't a fun little game. This is a question of power and class conflict. So clearly they're not going to pull out the stops for anything that seems to threaten the status quo. And the Greens simply just weren't up to the task. So we see these waves every so often. There was a wave of success at the local level, you know, after the Jesse Jackson campaigns for president in the 80s. So I'm not surprised that we see this wave now, especially because not only, you know, the campaign of Bernie Sanders got a lot of progressives in an electoral mindset, but also when there's, you know, an ascendant right, progressives tend to step up a bit more instead of, you know, being rather complacent. But in elections, like on Wall Street, past performance is not indicative of future results. You know, just because there's this wave of some people being elected who, you know, have better politics and policies, or at least platforms, than their opponents, that doesn't mean necessarily anything substantive is happening different from anything else. We can't look to elected officials as drivers of this change. At best, they're a reflection of it.
You know, one thing a lot of people will say is that something like DSA, which, you know, now, I mean, like, you know, candidates will literally go and like lobby and, you know, basically fight to get, you know, the DSA to back them. But what a lot of people will say is that, you know, a group like the DSA is pushing the Democrats to the left, which a lot of people respond with saying, well, yeah, well, the Democrats are pushing this organization, you know, to the right. You know, how would you respond to that?
Yeah, no, I think you're right. Look, Occupy Wall Street pushed Democrats to the left. Black Lives Matter pushed Democrats to the left. The immigrant rights movement pushed Democrats to the left. It's, you know, in the end, it's all about leverage. So the metaphor I like to use is, you know, the seesaws on playgrounds. So if you want to move the guy on the other side, you get more people on your side. You don't cross over and join him. Right? You remove all your leverage when you do that. So when the left tries to enter the state, that's when you lose that leverage. I've seen this, you know, especially in internal debates within DSA. You know, once that endorsement is won, all that leverage goes away. So it's a, you know, it's a serious issue that they're going to have to deal with. Again, this isn't actually how we build movements to get beyond capitalism, if that is indeed their goal. And I think for a lot of people in there, it is, honestly. You know, capitalism doesn't require that government be entirely made up of people who own the means of production, right? Sure, there are quite a few, obviously, but it's not a deal breaker if you're not. So the problem in terms of getting not only left reforms done, but building left momentum to overcome the system entirely, it's not a personnel problem. It's not a problem of pushing new people into office that will do other things. It's, you know, really what matters is the balance of class forces. You know, in the short run, what matters to capitalists is that they are more effective at intimidating policymakers than the working class is. And what matters to them in the long run, even if they have to make compromises, ensuring that, you know, the government protects the foundations of capitalism. So playing the endorsement game, that is fun and it's full of drama. And DSA Boston in particular was just blowing up around that, which I, you know, was very entertained at. But that's not building power in any meaningful sense. Because look, I mean, I think the history of trade unions and, you know, labor movements in this country is a great example of Democrats and progressives talking a good game, getting an endorsement, and then throwing them under the bus because the real people in charge are the capitalists. That's why we didn't get the Employee Free Choice Act when the Democrats ran Congress and the presidency, you know, between 2008 and 2010. Because, look, those Democrats went to those union halls. They, you know, they lobbied, they cajoled, they sweet-talked. Obama got all those endorsements. Conservative Democrats got union endorsements. And look at what they got. Look at the downward trajectory of the union movement under right. Democrats.
Now there are a lot of workers that will say, like, well, why should I have to give up union dues for this union that doesn't really do much for me? You know? And the union is such like an alienated thing from anybody's, you know, lived experience. It's not a vehicle in which people fight, or it's not like a collective organ that people are all, you know, coming together to, you know, create. It's just, you know, another bureaucracy that they have to navigate. I mean, you go to a lot of workplaces and there's a lot of people that, you know, like with this recent Janus ruling, which basically says that workers can, even if they're represented by a union and they benefit from collective bargaining, that they can opt out essentially of having to pay union dues, which a lot of unions, you know, are very opposed to. And, you know, a lot of that's money that they're sending to the Democratic Party. So that's going to, you know, have lots of effect on, you know, that whole relationship as well.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, the unions were, you know, as someone who has friends in them and, you know, has occasionally worked near them, they weren't nearly as prepared as they should have been for this. They should have seen this coming. Like, it's really shameful. But yeah, these large unions are largely top down. They have cozy relationships with giant employers that employ most of their members. They're all we have if we want to think about huge union forces. And unfortunately, they tend to take the wrong side of things on often on occasions. But thankfully, like as I'm sure your union listeners know, you know, there are insurgent both unions like the Wobblies, but also union movements of you know, rank and file members inside these larger like business unions that are actually moving things and are actually making demands on union leadership and forcing them to step up to fight for their workers and, you know,
which I mean,
ultimately change the internal structure of unions to be more democratic. Right.
And I think that, you know, those struggles that you speak of really speak to kind of, you know, what we're going over. I mean, they were, you know, like we're talking about the Wildcat strikes that took place in with educational and teacher workers. And we've had teachers that were on strike mm-hmm. on this program several times in different states. But I mean, those were strikes not only against, you know, the conditions those people were up against, but also, you know, the union itself and also the Democratic Party, which sought to, you know, force them to go back and take these really piecemeal things.
It was outrageous mm-hmm. the way that both Democrats and their own, you know, teacher union leaders at the national level sold them down the river and tried to squash the Wildcat strikes, which is what union leadership always tries to do, right? This is tale as old as time. But the fact that they were able to, you know, these teachers who organized at a grassroots level from the bottom up, who used, frankly, anarchist methods, I think, of organizing, you could say, they were able to wring significant concessions from right-wing Republican governors and legislators, which blows up the theory that we need to have some sort of inside-out strategy to get anything done. We just need a strong enough outside and against strategy. That'll do it.
Well, let's continue on because, you know, much of the left will argue, you know, well, it's not like what DSA is doing, trying to like move the Democrats to the left. We need a workers' party. And that's kind of, you know, the magic words that a lot of people have on the tips of their tongues. Like, you know, Jacobin magazine will argue that there needs to be a workers' party that's created. You know, a lot of left groups, that's their end goal, is the creation of a workers' party. You know, at the same time, I mean, it seems, you know, as history progresses and just things continue to get worse, I mean, the idea that there's going to be a viable third party that's going to exist within the electoral sphere just seems completely out of the realm of any possibility. I'm just curious your thoughts.
Leninists, and I think a lot of other third party fans, are really good at describing the mountains of failures to change the Democratic Party from the inside into a working class party. And they're absolutely right. They make very good points. Everything's well documented. You know, there's Paul Street is always putting out some, you know, new diatribe against the dollar-soaked Dems. And there's, you know, histories of the Democratic Party that show it's always handmade in the capital.
Glenn Ford from the Black Agenda Report is also another good one.
Yes, right. Yeah, he totally gets that. However, what they fail to mention, and that really disappoints me, is that, you know, right behind that mountain is an equally large mountain made up of the failures to create a viable third party in the U.S. And they don't really talk about that. They assume that, well, this time it'll be different. You know, this is Lucy taking the football away from Charlie Brown Aladdin. You know, well, this time we're going to have a viable third party. This time we'll have a real working class party, or the U.S. Labor Party. It's been tried so many times, and inexorably they are either absorbed into the Democratic Party or they simply disband under their own weight. They simply dissolve. So there's not a great track record. Actually, there is a third party at the local and state level here in Vermont called the Vermont Progressive Party. However, the story of that is similar to the Democrats and similar to other parties of the quote unquote left, you know, like the NDP in Canada. There's always this gradual right slide. The closer they are to actually having power, the further to the right their policies and platforms go. And then I would also say, look at the actual socialist parties in Europe, the ones that everybody looks to and pines for. You know, the Green Party is like, well, I wish we could be like the Green Party in Germany. They have, you know, they've been in governments before and they've wielded power and stuff. But, you know, they've also been used to prop up conservative governments. The Green Party, which has control, or at least had control over the town of Brighton in England, which is sort of like this Green Party haven. One of the workers called them Tories on bikes, because they were simply, you know, they had a great veneer, but they were, because they're trapped inside the system, they were left to implement austerity that somebody else decided on. And that's what we see across Europe. Social democratic parties, first off, they're failing to govern in the first place. And secondly, when they do, they're the parties of austerity. They can do austerity better than the right-wing parties because left-wing social movements and unions are confused about how to oppose them, or it causes dissension and division. You can look at...
They can also rein people in and tell them what to do, which is, you know, what unions do now or when they, you know, prop up, you know, austerity pushing Democrats.
Oh, exactly. They're like, well, this is the best we can do, right?
Exactly, yeah.
Yeah, we're being pragmatic. Oh, you don't want the conservatives in power, do you? Right.
Right.
Like it's a, yeah, it's an old playbook. But if you look at Mitterrand, who got into office, high hopes, 1981, president of France, in office with like actual Communist Party of France politicians. 1981 gets in, they talk about nationalization. They talk about huge increases to welfare and old age pensions. You know, they're talking the right game. Mitterrand was talking about this, you know, French path to socialism away from capitalism. By 1983, 2 years later, he had to reverse course and implement austerity because the international markets simply refused to allow it to happen. They created an economic crisis. Mitterrand had to say goodbye to all his plans. Going back to Greek, you know, Andreas Papandreou, who also got elected prime minister in Greece in 1981, brought PASOK into power, abandoned almost all of his radical rhetoric during the campaign. He said he was going to get out of the EU. He said he was going to get out of NATO. And in the end, he simply implemented, you know, basic progressive reforms like National Health Service. Things were so bad in Greece. You know, there was essentially no public services after the military dictatorship dissolved, that the really basic things that Papandreou did before his government fell under the shadow of corruption and clientelism. That was amazing by Greek standards, but it was barely at the level of social democrat, and it certainly didn't challenge capitalism.
Yeah, or even, so, I mean, yeah,
look, both here and abroad, I don't see the big draw of third parties or workers' parties.
Right. I was going to say, even with Trump, I mean, even with this recent, you know, zero tolerance separation ban, I mean, that lasted, what, 2 weeks? And, you know, people were on the streets, you know, and you know, there was a lot of people marching, and there was a lot of people, you know, outside of ICE stations, which still continues. But, it, you know, it wasn't like, you know, millions of people. It was, you know, a fairly small section of the population, and Trump, you know, within 2 weeks backed off. And
they were strategic too. You know, they weren't, you know, gathering in city halls. They were, you know, assembling at airports, which are key infrastructure points.
Right.
They were very strategic about that. And yeah, it paid dividends.
So just going forward, I mean, you know, we've been talking about social movements are a better way of, you know, building gains and forcing concessions and elections and third parties and party politics working within the system. But can we give some examples of this in action?
Oh, totally. I mean, yeah, from my perspective, the history of social change informs anarchist strategy and ideas. So really all we have to do is examine that history to find examples. And excuse me, you know, time and time again, we're going to see that if you look at that history, you know, minor reforms are won when we, as, you know, members of the working class, can threaten the political survival of candidates and parties. And we can win major reforms when we threaten the entire political and economic system itself. And that is a tried and true formula that's worked throughout U.S. history. Look at the 1930s and 1960s. We have, in the 30s, we have the New Deal. In the 60s, we have Great Society. These are major expansions and redefinitions of what government does and what services are rendered. And, you know, speaks to major political realignments at the national and often at the state level. So liberals, when they see those, they see FDR and LBJ, right? I think what anarchists and other socialists see are the movements that forced those cautious politicians to wring concessions from the capitalist class because the alternative was revolt and revolution. So that's a formula I think we can learn from and build on. you know, what we focus on in Black Rose, for example, is building power through mass organizing. So things like labor unions, tenant unions, student unions that are democratic and grassroots centered, of course, and have a critical understanding of the nature of the fight itself. So everything from, the fast food workers who are unionizing, including the Burgerville workers in Portland, who just a couple months ago successfully unionized the first locale of a fast food joint. Incredibly inspiring work. Public school teachers in the South, we've got members working there. Neighborhood assemblies in places like Los Angeles. Here in Vermont, we're trying to rebuild what used to be a really incredible and militant tenant organizing movement. So the idea is find people where they are who are starting to, build these movements based around their structure, their structural position within the current system that we're all living in. So based around a common point of exploitation. That's why historically the workplace has been so important, or housing, for example,
And like you brought up earlier, when we go to school as kids and, go through public schools and, receive what the government tells us, we get this idea that, the government, the state is this neutral entity and that, it responds well to nonviolent appeals, for social change. And that's, how we, got the labor movement, and that's how we got, the civil rights movement. And out of that, we get modern society.
Right.
Which is, post-racial and, it's neoliberal. Everybody has access to the same amount of resources and, we can climb up the class ladder and so on and so forth. And we all know that's not true. But I mean, when you go back and look at these, look at these periods in time, I think even beyond, what the left usually says, what the left says is that, there were powerful organizations which were there, which in some ways is true. But moreover, that there was just mass eruptions of revolt, riot, and occupations and wildcat strikes, which created an ungovernable situation, which forced the state to, grant concessions as a way to try to put the lid on what was happening in this country. I mean, if you go back to the mid-1960s, I mean, there's literally examples of them passing like the Voting Rights Act or different acts, during the middle of, massive riots as a way to try to get people off the streets.
Right. And,
Right. And, even with, this current strike wave, even though it's much smaller than, say, post-World War II, I mean, you can look back at the strikes that have happened over the past year or so, under Trump, and you can see that they're gaining wages. They're forcing concessions. They're slowly kind of getting people back. And again, it just shows, if you get out of control, then you force the state to, like you said, make a concession.
Yeah,
that's a question of force.
Yeah, and your point about the consensus historical model that we're all taught in school, I think is spot on. It's according to them, it's aside from wars, it's a continual progress of elites being morally persuaded by the plight of the poor. These liberals, they see the poor in the streets and their heartstrings are pulled. And so they pass welfare. Like, that's not how that works at all. And it's, of course, in elite's best interest to not tell us about this history, to not tell how change actually happens.
To me, this is a big question. And a lot of people say this, especially on the left. But this idea of supposedly fighting with both fists, meaning that we need strong movements, but at the same time, we need that electoral component to really, hammer those concessions home. What would you say to those people that say we need to fight with both fists?
Yeah, so this idea isn't really new, but there's never, especially more recently when I've heard it proffered in, just talking with people or in think pieces or Jacobin articles, they just say, inside outside, or we have to do both, as if it's self-evident, and then they just move on. There's no real critical examination of what that means and why it's apparently necessary that we do both. I can understand, especially post-Occupy, why some largely issue-based organizers who were disillusioned by how Occupy ended, looked to electoral politics for the first time and saw it and were just sort of dazzled by it. They can see, wow, this is a great shortcut. This is a good addition to our toolbox, as a lot of them like to say. But this isn't like other tools. Electoral campaigning is unique in that it actively sabotages the other tools in your toolbox. This is different from the rest of the things that the left does, at least the good things that the left does. Movements that throw their energy into political candidates, as we've seen, are sawing off the branch they're sitting on. They're putting energy into something that saps the energy from the movements, the very thing that a politician would need around to keep them accountable is gone because that energy was put into getting them elected in the first place. Like you said in the beginning, we put out several pieces around sort of the larger electoral question, and the most recent one we put out talks about how, from A to Z, from the point where you start planning the candidate's selection to the election day and then beyond, at every step of the way, the necessary processes and activities that campaigns go through are either unrelated to, at best, or harmful to, at worst, the larger social movements and the very issues you want to actually move the needle on. The historical record, I think, is pretty damning. The most important factor in terms of whether major reforms are won is the strength of social movements and labor movements, not who's in office. It was Richard Nixon, a Republican, who signed the EPA and OSHA into existence during a historical cresting of popular movements from below, right? But on the other hand, it was Clinton, a Democrat, who gutted welfare, who passed NAFTA, who opened the door for media consolidation and monopoly. And of course, that was during a low tide in social movement strength. So, who's in power has a lot less to do with what happens than who's in the streets. Howard Zinn had a quote along those lines. It doesn't matter who's sitting in the White House, but who's sitting in. Those reforms I just mentioned, they're pretty minor, relatively speaking. To actually tweak the foundations of capital accumulation itself, that's a whole other ballgame entirely.
Right.
Leftists in power who have actually tried to do that on occasion have either, as we saw, had their economies sunk by a capital strike, or they're just overthrown by a military coup. Capitalism over the course of the 20th century has proven entirely uncommittal to the trappings of modern representative democracy. It doesn't need it. It didn't need it in Chile. It didn't need it in Greece. All across the world, we saw that. So that's a real danger. And it's one that all the, the leftist think pieces in the world fail to grapple with. How do you stop that? And of course, if you press them on it, they'll say, well, we need strong social movements in the streets to back up these politicians who are trying to do all these brave, noble things. And like, these two are largely incompatible.
Is there anything positive then, or how should we look at the growth of interest in things like DSA or socialist or democratic socialist candidates? I mean, what does that mean for us as anarchists or autonomists at this time when there's increasing visible displeasure with capitalism? I mean, a lot of polls are saying that half of millennials reject capitalism as a governing system,
right?
What does that mean for us?
Yeah, I mean, I think, look, after a wave of leftist candidates like we're seeing, there's inevitably going to be a wave of disillusionment. And anarchists need to be there in social movement spaces to show people that they shouldn't give up on radical change. They were right in the first place. They shouldn't descend into apathy. They just need a better strategy, one that speaks to the world that's around them and takes seriously the question of both capitalism and the state. I'd also say that anarchists shouldn't automatically cede the word socialism to Leninists and social democrats. I know it's easy, especially, for folks who are extremely online to, really want to grab onto a label and shout it from the rooftop. But we all have to remember what it was like for us to radicalize in the first place. back then, you know, for a lot of us, labels were largely interchangeable at one phase. And, you know, this was a movement internal to ourselves as we were grappling with these issues we had only vaguely thought of before, and now have these all these competing frameworks to try and figure out. So I think we can use the S word just as we use the A word.
So I think that begs the question of, you know, and I know the DSA is, you know, different, and there's different caucuses within it. There's people that are into direct action, and there's people that are really interested in elections, and there's a lot of different kinds of people within DSA. But, you know, in general, do you have any ideas about what our relationship would be with a growing organization like the DSA? Because if you look at the people that are on the streets and, you know, are engaged in, you know, various movements, I mean, you know, the DSA is a rising force along with anarchists as well.
I think that's right. And like you said, DSA is, as it stands, a multi-tendency organization. So the composition of locals really varies widely. You know, I know quite a few good class struggle anarchists who happen to be in DSA because that's the largest left formation around them. And people inside those locals happen to be doing good, you know, mass organizing work they'd be doing otherwise. You know, some of them are members of the Libertarian Socialist Caucus, which itself is pretty heterogeneous. And I think that can sometimes raise red flags, or I guess red and black flags. But what worries me about LSC is that I fear for at least some of them, you know, instead of being a foothold of anarchist ideas in a largely electoralist organization, in some senses, we're seeing the opposite. So LSC is being a foothold of electoralist ideas in the anarchist movement. And that's a little worrying. I think part of that is due to Murray Bookchin's sort of libertarian municipalism, unfortunately coming back into fashion. There's this, you know, line of thinking that suggests that really all the problems with state power will either disappear at the local level or are small enough to overcome if we focus on, you know, towns and cities, which it's silly. So like most questions, it really depends on, I think, how things are playing out locally. For example, some of the most innovative tenant organizing I've seen in years is actually being done out of the Washington, D.C. chapter of DSA. So it really varies from local level, and I'd recommend.
Can you just speak a little bit to that?
They're just trying interesting and new things. For example, what they're calling it is, I think it's the Stomp Out Slumlords campaign is what they're calling it. So they have a working group. They got started looking at, instead of just doing like generic canvassing through neighborhoods, you know, hi, I'm with the DSA. Does your landlord suck? Tell me more. You know, which is just a total dead end unless you're doing it strategically. They actually started going to the housing court. The docket is publicly available. They can go in. I think for some municipalities, you can just go online and look, and you can see which ones are about evictions, either directly or you can tell by a few indirect details. And what they would do is, you know, their starting point was they would intervene there because they found that almost all the time the tenant doesn't show up. If they do, they don't know what's going on. They don't have a lawyer. So there are really easy, light touch procedural things they can do to go with the works, to make it harder for landlords to get an easy eviction, to get an easy deposit confiscated. And then that's a great way of finding people who are the most disadvantaged by, you know, or the rapidly gentrifying housing system in DC. And they're, you know, as they're growing, they're allowing the tenants who are participating to really drive the direction of the organizing efforts, which I think is also really smart. So there are, you know, some great things that are going on. So what I would recommend for anarchists who have DSA locals nearby is don't automatically dismiss them. See what they're doing and judge them substantively on their contributions to, you know, building class awareness, to building struggles and organizations that, you know, can actually seriously challenge the powers that be. If they're just, you know, running liberal Democrats and doing GOTV, yeah, you can just feel free to ignore them. They're not going to bother you, right? You know, you can be busy you know, organizing people and getting shit done while they're, you know, trying to play palace intrigue in City Hall.
Yeah, very good point. I mean, what do you think of this interest, this kind of renewed interest? I know this weekend there was the Fearless Cities Conference, but this mm-hmm. kind of renewed interest around Bookchinism and municipalism. What do you think of that?
So I think it's and I can't wait to hear what the Libertarian Socialist Caucus folks on your next interview will sort of dig into this round. But the problem with municipalism, starting with Bookchin at least, is this was part of him trying to figure out how to make a revolution, how to get past capitalism without actually involving the working class. Part of his intellectual trajectory through the 80s into the 90s and, you know, a little bit into the 2000s, he really stopped writing soon after the turn of the century, was this growing disillusionment with the ability of the working class to actually do the kind of mass strike action and organization that got us so close in Spain, in Russia, in Hungary, in Poland, elsewhere, when you had militant working class movements. He basically, you know, he got frustrated and he gave up. He said, this is no longer an option anymore. How do we think of another, what he called, you know, revolutionary subject? Like, what's that kind of person? So he seized on what he called the citizen. So he looked at, you know, councils that sort of sprung up and general assemblies that sprung up during various historical revolutionary moments and said, yeah, we need more of this. And I think to a certain extent, you know, he's spot on. You know, in the French Revolution, in the Russian Revolution, even in the American Revolution, you know, in the American case, it's the town hall meetings, or the town meetings, which are common in New England, but not really common anywhere else. You had mass assemblies, democratically organized, of people who were nearby who made decisions and made them in a radical way. Now, one of the things actually, it was interesting reading his work about the American Revolution was how scared Southern aristocrats were, and even in the middle colonies too, of these general assemblies because they saw them voting away the power of the wealthy. So they're like, we have to stop that. So I can understand Bookchin really seizing on that. But it's a vision of how to get there that just seems incredibly implausible and doesn't line up with actual history.
Right. What also implies that the wealthy are never going to be like, well, you know, I guess we'll just have to shoot you and not allow you to vote away our wealth because we own all the guns and we, you know, own all the cops. And I mean, also just, you know, this idea of the citizen, I feel like that class of people, which, you know, by and large sounds a lot like, you know, the centrist that is left alive and, you know, the United States that feels that the state is this neutral instrument that will be the one thing that can solve all the problems. I mean, that's the kind of thinking that really is like at the heart of so many problems. You know, it's like it's the masses and masses of people that, you know, are so fed up with everything, but yet they seemingly have no confidence or time or ability to organize with everybody like them, you know. Those are the ones we want to talk to, not the people that are like, well, the just got to write that letter to the editor, you know?
Yeah. And it's sad because, you know, these are otherwise really good organizers have, you know, these days have really good, opinions and strategies and ideas about other things, but they get tripped up on this idea that we can elect people to city government and then they can democratize everything for us and codify it. And then we link these cities together. And eventually at some point there's enough cities that we can, you know, declare capitalism overthrown or, you know, have some final confrontation with the state. That's the, in a nutshell, that's Bookchin's vision. And that's what a lot of people who have this municipalist mindset are going for. And it's a total joke. And what's been really educating for me living in Burlington is that we actually sort of had an attempt at that. Soon after Bernie got into office in 81, next time we chat, I can tell you all about how Bernie proved how local politicians totally fail, as you know, just like the state and national ones do. But there were these things called neighborhood planning assemblies, and it was totally municipalist. You know, Bookchin and his followers were big in Burlington politics. His wife actually ran for city council. And the idea is, by ward, you know, each ward in Burlington would have these neighborhood assemblies where people would come together, and then they would not only deliberate on the matters of the day, that's attending City Hall, but they would also be given a big chunk of money with which they could democratically decide, you know, what to do with in their locale. So build a new park or put in a new stoplight or something like that, sort of like participatory budgeting kind of, you know, but before that was a big fad. And as we saw, and as we will inevitably see anywhere else this is tried in similar environment, the NPAs were useful for Bernie and other elected politicians when they already agreed with each other. So NPAs that were on board with the policy agenda, they were great. They attended them. They, you know, supported them. They were wonderful. But to the extent that there was any friction or disagreement between the two of them, the NPAs got the short end of the stick. They were just completely ignored. And of course, you know, in such situations, people eventually lose interest. Certainly the working class people who, you know, need to like put their kids to bed or need to work second shift. So very quickly you have, it's the most privileged and well-to-do members of that ward who are showing up to make these decisions. This is where you get into some dangerous, like cross-class alliance territory that I think is implicit in municipalist visions, which is very dangerous. And now NPAs are just a shell of themselves. They're little talking shops. They're barely given enough money per year to even like rent out a room to hold a meeting. It's really sad. But it's entirely unsurprising for someone who's actually, you know, looking at the structural balance of forces here. You can't impose democracy from above.
When we're talking about, you know, all these criticisms of electoralism, how do you think we can actually, you know, weaponize this and use it to kind of split these formations, you know, along lines that would, I hate to say it like this, but, but split these things along lines that's, you know, helpful for us as anarchists and expose the contradictions between the people that really do want kind of a collective working class, you know, action-based program and people that do want the left wing of the Democrats.
That's so sneaky of you. I'm twirling my built mustache right now. I can't see it. Like I said before, I think, you know, one thing we need to do is educate the left, especially those who are newly radicalized. We as anarchists and anarchist organizations need to be, at least in some measure, in some fashion, super accessible. Uh-huh. Obviously, there's security culture concerns that are very legit, and I don't want to downplay those, but we have to find a balance. There needs to, you know, we need to, and this sort of feeds into, I think, the second thing we need to do is, you know, we need to make sure that militant social movement organizing has just as easy an on-ramp to participation as electoral work. And electoral work is super easy. You know, I don't think we'd be doing the same things, obviously. You know, when you volunteer for a campaign, you're stuffing envelopes, you're going door to door, you're knocking, you're phoning. You know, some of that stuff I think you could be doing in an anarchist context. Certainly the nature of it will be different. But we need easy on-ramps. We need this to become sort of the default organizing strategy and method and tactics for the larger left. And I think, you know, the anarchists in general have had a pretty good track record of that so far. If you look at, for example, Occupy Wall Street, that's in some important ways, you know, there's a lot of anarchist DNA in there that spread like wildfire across the country. And we didn't have to put anarchist, you know, field workers, you know, in all of these tiny little towns across the country. You know, this worked because we showed that it worked. And it was, you know, a rough and ready model that could be scaled up, that was usable and engaged people. So as we're building the social movements of the future, we need to keep that in mind, I think. And then really, you know, doing good work and letting people know in, you know, maybe like a humble brag kind of way, right? But letting people know that, yes, we're doing out there doing good work, that's important too. I think there are a lot of anarchists I know who have done years and years, you know, decades of incredibly important work. They're never sung. They're never trumpeted like, you know, a lot of the more reformist leftists are, because they have, you know, the bigger microphones and stuff. Part of what will inspire people to join us is when we celebrate our own, when we celebrate the things that, you know, we're doing for each other and for communities too. So not only putting in the work of doing anarchist organizing and showing in practice that this is the way we actually win, both in the short term and also, you know, the end game. But also doing it in a way that, you know, lets people know that it's existing and allows them to join.
You know, one of the things I'd like to touch on is, you know, we're talking so much about the DSA and, you know, how do we, you know, educate new people and stuff like that. How do we also combine this with the realization, as we said, that, you know, the vast majority of the population, the people that we really want to talk to, are totally disillusioned with everything we're talking about. And we don't need to convince them that, like, yeah, voting's a bunch of shit. And, you know, as opposed to, hey, like, let's actually organize around the things that make our lives miserable. So I'm curious if you have any thoughts on, you know, priorities and also just, you know, combining these things as well.
Oh, yeah. I mean, that's a really important part of our discussion, because, you know, it's easy, of course, to simply just dunk on other leftist groups or try to recruit from them, like poach members. Super easy, right? But what we need to do, and what's actually hard, is organizing people who aren't political right now, who understand still, like on a fundamental level, that shit's fucked up. Their boss is horrible. Their landlord is horrible. There has to be a better way of organizing society. There's a huge, you know, number of people who simply have checked out of the political process. And like you said, you know, those should be, you know, the people we're really trying to help organize themselves. And yeah, let's be honest, it's something that nobody on the left lately has been doing terribly well. Yeah, if you think of the radical or revolutionary left, you know, if you pick up, just to go back to earlier in our discussion about sort of the increasing popularity of socialism, if you look at opinion polls, the one demographic that's consistently been pro-socialism has been Black Americans. So even back in 2011, I think it was Pew, found that something like 53% of Black respondents had a favorable view of socialism. That's about 20 million people in America right there. That leftist groups have been historically so dang white, I think, should be a huge warning sign for us. You know, that tells me that the anti-capitalist organizations we build and the mass movements we support aren't doing their jobs, right? If we're engaging with those people who aren't engaged in our political system, I think our movements would and hopefully will look pretty different. And it's something, look, honestly, you know, Black Rose is not immune to that either. It's something we take seriously as a problem, and we're, you know, we're trying to confront in both internally and in our organizing. Now, granted, that's not to say that through sheer like willpower alone, the left can build a movement strong enough to overthrow capitalism. You know, the terrain we work on is not really of our choosing. Some moments I think will be easier than others. But you know, it's also worth noting that the state perceives Black radicalism especially as just uniquely dangerous. So this summer, I'm sure folks have seen on social media, this is the 40th anniversary of the bombing of the Move House in Philly. You know, through informants, disinformation, just outright police terror, the state has done everything in its power, legally and illegally, to strangle Black and Latinx liberation movements. And you know, to be clear, look, white supremacy, heteropatriarchy, capitalism, and the state, they grew up together and they still go hand in hand. We're going to have to defeat them all if we're going to defeat any one of them. And so I think, you know, from that perspective, we need to get out of our more insular tendencies on the left, especially as anarchists, since I think we have a very, you know, very positive vision for both what we can be doing in the here and now and what a future society can look like that avoids the mistakes that the statist left made over the course of the last 150 years or so. So we need to be, I think, I know Silicon Valley has really ruined the word innovation for me, but we need to innovate. You know, we need to think about new ways of organizing ourselves and others that speak to the unique economic and political terrain we're on now, because it really is unique.
Hey, thanks so much for joining us and for sharing your thoughts, and continue to look forward to all the stuff that Black Rose puts out. And, it's very welcome at this time. I'm glad that you all are continuously putting out, critical pieces about electoralism in the state. I think, it's easy to get, like IGD often does, get caught up in the news cycle and, everything that's happening, from pipeline fights to the latest mass mobilization. But it's good to, that people are thinking critically about this stuff when so many people are just going gaga over it.
Absolutely. Yeah. And thanks so much for having me on. Keep up the great work with these podcasts. They're fantastic.
Thank you. Have a good one.
This has been the It's Going Down podcast. Check itsgoingdown.org for daily updates, columns, action reports, and news. Go to itsgoingdown.org/shop to support us, and follow us on all social media platforms. IGD, your daily resource for insurgent proletarian life.